Welcome to the 62nd episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast for which going cold turkey is 6 months without an England test match.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? We constantly wonder at the people who put together the international schedule and whether they actually have A, any sense, or B, any desire to see decent cricket played at decent intervals. It's just one of those amazing ongoing sagas, isn't it, the way the test match schedule is put together. But test match cricket we may not have, but spiritual cricket we do have. There's been a wonderful thing I saw in the on the Guardian website the other day about a Vatican tour of the UK, and the St. Peter's 11, as they're wonderfully called, despite having apparently only ever having played street cricket, not having ever used a leather ball, and apparently not knowing the names of any fielding positions, have been touring the UK. They defeated the army chaplains in Aldershot and the Authors 11 in Buckinghamshire. But alas, the last match of their tour, they lost to the royal household in the grounds of Windsor Castle. And what a splendid idea that tour is, sort of straight out of the 19th century tradition.
I would love to see some of the sledging in these games. Presumably, yes. It would either be extremely niche, ecclesiastical references, or alternatively just, you know, unbelievably polite.
Yeah, well, they did. Father O'Higgins, who was the manager of the tour and also apparently the spiritual director of it, said, quotes, "This is not a holiday, but a spiritual venture." And actually, I was quite glad that finally the Vatican had realised that cricket was not something of leisure, but was in fact a spiritual venture, which is obviously something that we've known for many years.
I couldn't agree more. Cricket is all about teaching us, you know, our limitations and our mortality. That's what the sport is all about.
Indeed, and apparently on the Guardian website some footage from one of the matches. I couldn't get it to work earlier when I was trying to play it, but that might well be worth a watch. So I've been looking at priests playing cricket. What have you been looking at over the last couple of weeks?
I've been looking at Suliman Ben. Suliman Ben is officially back. Most cricketers conform to some sort of a type, and I think that is why we really have to treasure the true one-offs, these players who really try to achieve success in their own very unique way. I mean, Suliman Ben is a 6'7" left arm spinner from the land of the quick bowlers, and I think that makes him a very true one-off. He actually hadn't played test cricket for 4 years before New Zealand's tour of the Windies earlier this year. This week he bowled them to a series victory over Bangladesh. And I love watching him bowl. He's a very curious bowler. And because of his height, he obviously gets a huge amount of bounce. Very happy flighting the ball at a time when I think we're seeing more and more spinners look to dart it in, because often that's the way it works in 2020 cricket. He's a lovely mix between the languid and the very hostile. You might remember a couple of years ago, he got into a real scrap with Brad Haddin in test match.
Yeah.
So he's capable of that. But with 20...
Actually this is something that might, you know, he has the potential to become something of a sort of talisman at the heart of the West Indian team. He's been away for a while, obviously, but he's got a fair bit of experience on the international circuit. He's not a bad batsman, and he does have this kind of slightly maverick quality around him as a bowler. And the West Indies kind of need people who they can have at the heart of the team, and perhaps he's going to be one of them.
Well, one thing he certainly doesn't lack for is self-confidence, and I think that's been a real problem with Windies cricket generally in the last few years, that they turn up for these big games against the really big test teams and they don't really believe, I think a lot of the players don't really believe they're almost supposed to be there. Not a problem for Suliman Ben. So away from two lovely news stories of West Indian spinners and cricketing priests, things have been a little bit sadder in the county scene, haven't they?
They have. Well, it's kind of been quite a good summer for... Well, English summer, I say that as I'm about to go into the spring down here in Australia. But it's going to be quite a good English summer for county cricket, with a couple of exceptions. One of them, obviously, the plight of Leicestershire. The other one being the story at the end of the season of the altercation between Andrew Gale and Asheril Prince. Now, a lot has been written about this. Obviously, Andrew Gale said some slightly unsavoury words towards Asheril Prince. Andrew Gale was then, he was the Yorkshire captain, obviously, was then banned for several games. He was actually not allowed to lift the trophy at the end of the season, which seemed a little bit petty. The whole thing since sort of escalated further because the question of racism has come into it. Obviously, Prince is a black South African player who's one of the sort of international imports for the into the English county scene. Prince has come out and said that he wasn't the person who instigated this idea, that it might have been racist. Whether it was racist or not is kind of anyone's idea. It's just slightly unfortunate that this incident has become one of those ones which has been a sort of a rolling stone that has gathered moss, and it's now being played out in the papers through recrimination and counter-recrimination.
I thought you made a really nice point, actually, just before we came on air, when we talked about the fact that the ECB are struggling to deal with this, and partly it's because they just haven't really had to respond to incidents of this type before, frankly. Mm. I mean, I guess there's a really nuanced point here about, is calling someone a culpa, you know, is that a racist thing to say? But actually, whereas other sports, I mean, particularly football in the UK, I think has increasingly had to work out how you respond to racist slurs, it's a nice thing that actually this isn't a day-to-day problem in cricket.
No. Now, talking of cricketers behaving badly.
So, I headed down to grab the final day's cricket at the Oval for the summer. Derbyshire was strolling to victory at Surrey. And I saw Jade Dernbach make a very sort of half-hearted chase to stop a boundary, let it go. And a few Surrey fans nearby gave him what really was nothing more than good-natured banter. I mean, one of the comments was, you know, you're 28, not 48. They were having a laugh, you know, they'd been on the Foster since 11 o'clock. And he responded by casually flashing his middle finger at them. And it would have been fine if it sort of felt a part of a laugh, but there was a bit of hostility to it. He clearly felt himself above this. And the fans laughed it off, but I do feel it's sadly indicative of a group of players who take themselves too seriously and also don't really realise that the link between them and the fans is core. It's essential to the game. You know, it's not just that the fans are ultimately responsible for their wages, their salary, their interest. It's that actually that relationship's always been central to the game being something that people want to watch. I thought Steve Davis actually gave a lovely example about half an hour later of how to deal with it, when he got some similar kind of comments from the crowd and he turned round, smiled, offered a few comments back, and he thought it's not that difficult to do, and it'd be nice to see more players sticking with that course. From the archives, in this episode, Toby is going to treat us to a potted history of famous dressing room tantrums.
I was browsing through Crick Info the other day and I came across this gem of a film. It was one of those very press conferences as the like that I just never usually bother watching. And it was Ben Stokes reviewing his season. And he came up with some wonderfully wry humour when it came to the incident which put him out through injury for quite a lot of the season. When he punched the locker, he said this. He said, "It was quite a hard locker. If I go back there, I'll try and stay away from it." Now, one of the wonderful things about the dressing rooms is it's one of those spaces that's entirely private at one point, and also it's where some of the most amusing anecdotes in the game have actually developed. And I was actually surprised by the sort of the strength, the pedigree of the dressing room tantrums that have happened over the last few decades. And so I've been doing a little bit of rummaging through the archives to find some of the most amusing. Now, Hansi Cronje, he was obviously the pin-up gentleman of cricket until his corruption became evident, had a notorious temper in the dressing room. And once, after being given out, he managed to shove a stump through the door of the umpire's dressing room, which I think is quite a good achievement. Similarly, in the vein of
was
just
the umpire
sort of,
there at the time? Do we have any evidence?
I don't think so. I think he'd come off the Cronje had been batting. He came off the pitch, picked up a spare stump, and just punctured the door of the umpire's dressing room with it. Which, particularly in an age when actually there's no DRS, you know, you have to really stay on the right side of the umpire, is just a bit stupid, really. On the same lines of just sort of wanton criminal damage, the Australian Dan Christian was recently given a ban for smashing up three dressing rooms in succession after a series of failures with the bat. And you kind of wonder why the powers that be didn't realise that there was a bit of a pattern going on here and decided to sort of just bubble wrap everything in the dressing room ready for when you got out.
I'm curious in that case what the teammates are doing. Do you just run for cover? Do you say, "Oh God, Dan's out cheaply again, let's just get out of here"? Doesn't anyone try and, you know, arm round the shoulder, "Come on, Dan, you know, three is getting careless by this stage"? I mean,
now that's a really interesting point, because actually I've been reading a few articles about this, and apparently actually the thing for people did was just to disappear, to get out of the, when a notorious smasher got out, the rest of the players would just get dressing room. They'd sit in the corner, mind their own business, read the paper, and just let it happen, is apparently the way that happened. Now, one of the great joys of dressing room incidents is the way that often they're explained away in the press. Ricky Ponting at the last World Cup in India inflicted some damage on a television. And it was explained thus in the press. After being run out, Ponting threw his groin protector at his kit bag on his return to the dressing room, after which it ricocheted off a hard item at the top of the bag and struck the side of a flat-screen TV that was sitting on a shallow table immediately beside the bag. Sorry, excuse me. And that kind of just has the sense of one of those excuses I'd have cooked up as a schoolboy. And in fact, as well, you sort of wonder logistically how this could
actually
happen.
I'd love to see it recreated.
No, exactly.
It's like one of those old, those sort of Nissan TV adverts where kind of 10 things have to hit each other in perfect harmony for some little nut at the end to like roll off the scale. I mean, that actually would take some doing.
Well, there was another instance of the ricochet, I'm not very good at saying that word, the ricochet excuse, which was around the incident at Lord's when Matt Prior smashed a window. And Andrew Strauss came out at the end of the day, and there's this wonderful statement, which if anyone can actually make head or tail of, I'll be very impressed, and I'd actually like to know what it means. It was one of those unfortunate incidents, Strauss said. Matt didn't mean to break the window at all. He holds all his bats against the wall, and he put it there, not sure what it is, and it bounced off the other bat and hit the window. Hopefully it won't happen again.
That suggests an interesting definition of the word put. Because if you put things that you put down rarely bounce. I mean, we'd live in an altogether more interesting world if I put my wallet down and it bounced off the table and smashed a window.
Blew off.
I mean, it'd be an expensive and very difficult world to live in generally, but.
Now, what is very refreshing, actually, is Matthew Hayden, when he was once given out at the SCG and a smashed window ensued, and he was asked about how this happened, and he just said very honestly, yeah, I just smashed it. Just put my bat through it. And actually, you kind of prefer that sense of honesty about the whole thing. Now, of course, Ben Stokes, when he smashed his hand into the locker, he was I think he broke some bones in his hand, and he was out for the rest of the season. And there's a wonderful kind of poetic justice in the fact that, you know, you sustain injury through being unable to control your temper. And actually, many of the best dressing room incidents are around those things where people actually manage to injure themselves quite badly from the ways that they've taken out their temper tantrums. So Mike Gassing once punched his hand through a door at Lord's and needed 20 stitches. Mike Atherton, quite amusingly, was once given out at Port Elizabeth, and he thought it was a bad decision, and he came into the dressing room and kicked a pair of scales that was in a sort of little ante room to the dressing room. And legend has it that the rest of the team heard him come into this little room, kick the thing. Then there was complete silence until there was this little voice asking if the physio could come through because he'd really, really hurt his toe. And in fact, it turned out that he'd broken his toe. Nasser Hussain, meanwhile, at Queen's Park Oval in Trinidad, punched the locker. And unlike the locker that Stokes punched, which was obviously metal, the one that Hussain punched was made out of wooden slats, and he punched it, and then I suppose a little bit like a sort of a one-way funnel almost, he punched it and couldn't actually pull his hand back, because whenever he pulled his hand back, the wooden shards that he created when he punched it sort of dug into his flesh, so he had to call a teammate over to actually help him escape. But my favourite is Mike Rosebery, who's the Middlesex opener, who when he was given out once at Lord's, stormed into the dressing room and gave a sort of an armchair sitting next to the door beating with his bat. He then went off, you know, whatever, had a cold shower, calmed down a little bit, and then decided he needed to sit down. And he went back and he sat on the chair, and the chair promptly just disintegrated under him because all the rivets had been loosened by his earlier blows.
Now, there seems to be a lovely message emerging from all of these, which is that ultimately, as you'd phrase it when you said poetic justice, ultimately, if you respond to your dismissal with anger, you generally seem to get some sort of comeuppance. So this almost seems to be the spirit of cricket speaking to these players and saying, you know, take your failure like a man, go off, you know, feel upset for a bit, smile and get on with it.
Now, there's one last, and I think rather brilliant anecdote along those lines, but actually where it hasn't been the angry batsman who has suffered, it's actually been one of their teammates. Mark Ramprakash, who was notorious for his dressing room tantrums, was once given out, stomped into the dressing room and took it out on a stray helmet that was lying on the side. Ben Holyoake, who had apparently actually left the room in order to avoid seeing Ramprakash, because Ben Holyoake was the next man in, he knew Ramprakash would be furious and he didn't want to see this. He was in the zone before he went in for his innings. He then came into the dressing room, picked up his helmet, walked out to the middle, got to the middle, started putting his helmet on, and it was in a significantly different shape than it had been when he had last seen it, and the grill was apparently in a slightly unorthodox position on the helmet, and of course that was the one that Mark Ramprakash had given a good smashing to about 5 minutes before.
It's worth noting as well that I've come across plenty of club cricketers who, although their ability falls a long way short of these players, seem to like to emulate them in this way. I've seen some great strops from club players, and I must say I think there's always something particularly sad about it when it's from a player who basically isn't very good. If you're not very good and you go out and get out cheaply and you come back in and throw your bat at the wall and stuff, it all feels a little bit pathetic. I mean, you know, if you're Mark Ramprakash and you go out cheaply, I don't know if it's acceptable, but you can at least see a rationale behind it. You know, when it's Bill at the club, it always seems a bit less convincing.
The review, and for this episode we have been reading Slipless in Settle, A Slow Turn Around Northern Cricket by Harry Pearson. Now this book was the MCC Book of the Year, and it was also the Cricket Book of the Year winner at the British Sports Book Awards. It was published in 2010. Now Harry Pearson, we were just actually doing a little bit of Googling, trying to work out his history, and actually he seems to say it all at the beginning of the book, so we're just going to shamelessly just read it out in his own words. After many years spent working in jobs that required overalls or paper hats, and by the way, we're intrigued what that actually means, his life was altered forever by reading an article about Alan Foggan in the football magazine When Saturday Comes. Since then, he has written 7 books, including The Far Corner, and contributed to a dozen more. He has written for When Saturday Comes for 20 years, and as a weekly columnist for The Guardian. So this book has been much applauded with awards various. Was it worth it?
It certainly was. I mean, it's a brilliant book for defying categorisation. It's part match reports, part travelogue, part history, and just part Harry Pearson's musings about the game. And in that regard, it's very similar to a book that we have an awful lot of affection for in this podcast, which is Duncan Hamilton's A Last English Summer. And it's increasingly making me think that sort of mix of genres works extremely well as a cricket book. Mm. Whereas Hamilton, I think, goes for very high prose. I mean, he goes for the sort of Neville Cardus almost approach to cricket writing. Harry Pearson's more like your sort of wise-cracking uncle, but none the worse for that.
No, I was just going to say that one of the things that is quite distinctive for me about this book is the sort of social history element of it. So basically, the idea is that in one summer, Harry Pearson sets out to watch a game at every single one of the clubs that play within the Lancashire League. And the sort of the premise at the beginning of the book is cricket as it's played in the north, which he defines as anywhere above the Humber, rather amusingly making Geoffrey Boycott a southerner. The premise is cricket played in the north still as wonderful as it was in the golden days of the past? And one of the things that comes out of his travels around the north of England is actually his descriptions of the villages and the communities and the social change that's gone on. Actually, the food as well. There's some wonderful descriptions of the various sort of teas that are prepared at each of the local clubs.
And that for me was a really engaging part of the book. A terrible southerner, but for me it was incredibly educational in that regard, because I was, as I went, I was Google mapping all of these places, working out where they were, and I realised that I feel like I've spent a bit of time in the north, and then I suddenly realised, God, all these worlds and all these communities that I was completely unaware of.
Yeah, and also he doesn't look at anything through rose-tinted spectacles. I mean, there are a lot of places that he turns up in and he says, actually, this place is pretty awful, you know, particularly old mining towns that have since been run down and are full of social deprivation and poverty, and there's not much there. He writes about things with a lot of affection, certainly, and with a quite sort of dispassionate eye sometimes as well.
I mean, in many ways, I think this book is an ode to the North. I think it's an ode to those communities, and I think you're quite right that he doesn't idealise it, but he's also, he is clearly fond of it, and he has this wonderful ear for dialogue. And so much of his portrayal of the North is basically these snippets of conversation. I could spend 20 minutes just giving these snippets, but I have to say the one that stuck with me the most was he overheard this old man being asked how are things going? And the old man replies, not great, to be honest. It's only the thought of getting the free TV license that's keeping me going. And it was that kind of dry wit and that sort of straight-up honesty that permeates all these little extracts. And there is an art to that, just to keeping your ears open, just picking up those little lines.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what makes it such an engaging read, actually. In terms of the cricket itself and the description of the cricket, so it's essentially the bulk of the book is made up of a series of descriptions of cricket matches. And in the very last one, which is the game that he talks about as being his favourite, he describes cricket in the North as being, quotes, cricket with the crust still on. And there's this wonderful sense in which he really gets down to the sort of the nitty-gritty of the matches, and it's really not a sort of idealized version, just in his descriptions of the North and the North socially. It's not an idealized version of cricket
He's not looking for the village cricket that we see on terribly twee pictures, the sort of old jolly good chaps kind of version of cricket. His favourite game is his final one. I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly. At Tonge, I think it's called, where he describes the cricket he sees
or,
there.
Or Tonga. I wondered whether it was Tonga, but that obviously would confuse it with a small island that probably wasn't where it was. But yeah, T-O-N-G-E.
Yeah, we're badly lacking a northern correspondent on this podcast. And he describes the cricket there as rough, rude, shaven-headed, certainly, but it was also high quality, ferocious and unique. And this kind of gave me pause to ponder a little bit, because this game involved some pretty aggressive sledging. And I thought it's interesting that really attracted him, because for a lot of people when they see that, that's kind of seen as cricket going to the dogs. But for him, he loved that. He loved cricket being played in that way. And I think the key word actually there in that quote is unique. You know, he says that this is a particular brand of cricket that needs to be treasured.
There's also a kind of financial edge to the whole thing as well, because there's still this system of having every team has a professional or two professionals. The law changed. It was originally one they were allowed and subsequently two. And this kind of edge that's brought from, you know, it's not the counter cricket, oh, it's just a game, now let's have some cucumber sandwiches with the crusts cut off, that actually the professional is there to do a job. And they have a bucket or a hat or the bottom half of a lettuce dryer or something that's handed round once when a pro gets five wickets, and they do a collection around the ground. And there is that sense of there being, you know, a business-like attitude towards cricket as well that takes it further away from, as you say, this sort of slightly sentimental southern view of the game.
And in his history of the Northern League, he really does, on the Northern Leagues, he really does focus on the pros. And what he shows very nicely, I think, is that the Northern Leagues for years and years were really the home of some very talented cricketing outcasts. He focuses on a lot of international players who were supremely talented, but for various reasons ruled themselves out of playing for their country. I won't get that. There was sort of Roy Gilchrist, the West Indian, Sec Pepper, the Australian. The one I will give the anecdote on is poor Bobby Peel, who, a supremely talented all-rounder, who was banned from playing for Yorkshire after an all-night booze-a-thon, which finished with him mistaking the side screen for the wicket and then urinating on the pitch. And this, unfortunately, ruled him out of future selection for Yorkshire. And he gives a wonderful picture of actually how these Northern League clubs saw these players for the talented mavericks they were and gave them a home. And it slightly makes you wonder, I think, well, actually, now, there isn't such an obvious avenue for players like that, is there? I mean, you know, counties aren't going to tolerate that. The Northern League sadly don't have the money anymore really to support, really support talented pros.
And there is a little bit earlier about, as we were both saying, about the sort of, you know, the unsentimental edge to the cricket. There's some real tragedy as well. There's a story of, and I'd like to hear from the archives on him at some point, because I'd never come across him, a West Indian cricketer called Roy Gilchrist, who was apparently basically those who faced him and also faced Quicks at the time said that he was one of the quickest bowlers to ever have bowled in the history of cricket. And ends up having a temper that he can't control, and a spectator calls him a black bastard in a game, and he attacks that spectator, gets banned from playing cricket in any of the Northern Leagues, and then is sent back to the West Indies. As he's sent back to the West Indies, not knowing about this, call him up to the national team. By the time that he's arrived in the West Indies, the powers that be have discovered this anecdote, and he doesn't actually get to play. And there are these wonderful anecdotes, you know, some of them tragic, some of them humorous, which are about cricket now, but also the rich history of cricket in the Northern Leagues as well.
So I think, to summarise, this book comes with our strongest recommendation. To the interview, and this episode I spoke to cricket writer Freddie Wild. Freddie has written for the Bleacher Report, All Out Cricket and The Cricketer magazine. His live tweeting of major games has attracted a substantial following. So, Freddie, welcome to Reverse Swept Radio. I was very keen to pick up on your work that you've done for the Bleacher Report, because you've written very, very extensively for them. And I was keen to find out whether you get to a stage where you're producing so much that it starts to become a bit of a chore, or whether it remains fresh every time you write.
I would never say it's a chore, because I think that to write about cricket is something that I've always wanted to do. And it's, you know, a way of earning money to write about cricket is something I'm always going to enjoy. I think I'd rather do that than working in a pub or something. But I think there are some, I mean, I think it's probably the same for all writers, really. There are some topics or pieces you have to write which you don't enjoy as much. For example, if I'm previewing, you know, doing quite a dry preview for the fifth England-India one day, you know, when the series is long gone and you're fed up of the way England play one-day cricket, then that can be quite boring and quite hard work. But at the end of the day, I'm still writing about cricket. Yeah. So I never really see it as a chore. There's just certain topics which are more interesting than others. Well,
that was what I was curious to. So I can totally see that. You get to some games, and I think the ODI series are great examples where you get to the end of a series like that and everyone's struggling to care. But yeah. I'm curious, so what would be the example of a piece you'd really look forward to writing?
I really like doing sort of extensive features that take me, you know, a lot of time and planning for, you know, not necessarily for Bleacher Report, because that's a website, it's sort of more instantaneous, so you've got to write a reaction piece on the day to a day's play or something. But features that I do for magazines and things, I've written one for All Out Cricket recently, I did one earlier in the summer for The Cricketer, that you sort of take a lot of time planning, you talk to a lot of people, and you can really, I think the flavour of your writing can come across more, you can add a bit more colour into it, and basically you've just got more time to make it something you're more proud of, I think.
Because I'm very much with you in that I hugely enjoy the sort of long-form cricket writing, and I'm sure you've come across the Night Watchman, which is making a real art of that. I mean, do you think the appetite for that is strong? Because I think, I guess my one worry is that there seems to be a real move towards, I mean, it's not really a recent move, there's quite an extensive move towards sort of, as you were saying, sort of quick reaction blog posts online. Yeah. I mean, do you think there's going to be a strong audience going forward for those kind of longer, more thoughtful pieces?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, really. I mean, The Night Watchman, as you said, is something that's come out recently and done pretty well, and the Crick Info have just launched an online magazine as well, where they're sort of going for timeless long-form writing, and to me as a writer that massively appeals. I think that's, you know, my favorite genre, if you like, of writing is something which is timeless, and you can look back at 2 years and it's still kind of relevant, and the themes you've put in are still still appropriate. But yeah, there is a concern, you know, in the age of Twitter, where you've got people offering views in less than 140 characters, there is a worry, I think, that perhaps longer writing is going to sort of get pushed out of the market. But I still think there's an appetite for high quality long form writing. I think if there's a really good piece, you know, you'll see there's a guy actually doesn't write on cricket called Brian Phillips, who writes, he's a phenomenal long form writer, and he'll tweet something out and he'll get thousands of retweets for this article he's done, you know, and it's sometimes, you know, 8,000 words, but people love it. I think that it's all about the quality. If you can still write high quality, then people will read it however long it is.
Now, you raised an interesting point as well when you said, obviously, the making a living out of cricket writing. And it's one thing that comes up, I guess, whenever we interview writers, is the fact that there is... So what we get, we tend to get this interesting dichotomy where people who've been doing cricket writing for a long time tend to say, God, it's not like it was in the old days. And we similarly get younger writers, I guess, like as yourself, who are like starting to make progress and start findings, but are still a bit, I don't know, where would you put yourself in that spectrum? Are you optimistic about the chances to make a living out of cricket writing, or where would you rate yourself?
optimistic at the same time, sort of a little bit cautious. I think that what the great thing is now, because of the internet, it's so meritocratic. If you work hard enough and you're good enough, then because of Twitter, because of having blogs, you will get noticed, and therefore you've got a platform like you've never had. You know, 15 years ago, I can imagine it would have been a lot more difficult for me. You know, 2 or 3 years ago, I started up Twitter, started up a blog, and you can quite quickly get some momentum. The only worrying thing is, I suppose, in the sense if you're trying to earn money out of it, is that because there are now so many writers, that there's a bit more competition. And also, then again, there's an alarming trend, I think, developing, in that you've got the sort of the classic newspaper journalists, and I think they sort of look down their nose a little bit at the sort of new age of writers, if you like, coming through on blogs and on Twitter, and whether they can sort of crack that, or bridge the divide between, you know, the guys in the press box, if you like, and then the guys sitting at home, is sort of the next big challenge, I think, for all the bloggers out there.
I think that's a really interesting point, because what I find fascinating are people such as Jared Kimber, who've made that sort of jump from, obviously, Cricket with Balls, which was, I guess, in a lot of ways, one of the original really successful cricket blogs, and has now become a real staple on Crick Info. And I guess, I mean, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, do you think for the average... not the average blogger, for a blogger who's taking it seriously and doing it properly, is the ultimate aim to have a really good blog or website, or is the aim to do that move that Jared Kimber's done and go into a bigger mainstream organisation?
I think it kind of depends on the individual. I mean, there's a massive appeal to having a really great blog that gets loads of hits, and you sort of build a community on your blog, and that's fantastic and something to be really proud of. If you're looking to make a career out of it, then yeah, the way that Jared's gone is the way that I think a lot of people want to follow. And I think Crick Info, to be fair, should be given some credit for the cordon which has been set up, which is basically all of the good blogs are basically being thrown together on their website. And that's getting, you know, a lot of traction, and it means that they get a lot more hits, and more sort of lesser known writers of Unite are gaining prominence. It does depend on the individual, but I think that Jared's path is inspiring a lot of other people really to think, you know, I can make it from just starting out from my bedroom on a computer watching it on the TV, and you can, because he's done it.
Yeah, and I have to agree with you on Crick Info, because I think they're a great example of their incredibly powerful website, but as far as I can see it, they're using their power well. They're actually bringing great writers forward, giving them a voice, and I think their county cricket coverage is great. So away from writing, you're also a prolific podcaster with the Geek and Wild show, and I guess I've got sort of a particular interest with this as someone who's been involved in co-hosting a podcast for coming up to a couple of years now, and I wondered, with the Geek and Wild show, what do you feel is distinctive? How were you able to sort of to set out your niche? Because I mean, I'm a pretty regular listener, and I thought, you know, how did you see it when you were setting out? What were you trying to do?
Well, I think it's kind of come together a little bit by accident, and that we sort of started it literally as something, to add another string to our bow, in the sense that both myself and Peter looking to sort of make it to the, you know, full time, if you like, as a journalist. And I think that being able to do podcasting in the modern age is something you've got to be able to do. And so I don't think we really had any other aim than that initially, but. Interestingly, really, since England have started doing badly in the last 12 months, and everything with, you know, Peterson and Downton and Moores, and all this sort of this sort of created a divide of not kind of pro KP and anti KP, but the sort of the inside outside cricket thing, which, you know, the way they sort of ECB alluded to Piers Morgan as outside cricket. Course, I think that we've sort of liked the idea without purposefully doing this, but we've sort of taken the stance that we are outside cricket, and we are going to look in on the ECB, and we have been very critical of the ECB in the last 12 months or so, because we, you know, we look at it and we think they're doing, you know, they're making wrong decisions, and a lot of the mainstream media perhaps are not maybe questioning the ECB as much as we think they should be, and so therefore sort of inadvertently the podcast has had quite a sort of slotted into quite a nice niche, and that it challenges the ECB quite well, I think, and that's really by accident.
It's interesting, and do you find, I mean, I like the way you describe it, that I think for a modern cricket writer, you almost have to be able to do the podcasting and the writing. Do you find there are things that, I mean, this is always a silly way of putting it, but which do you find easier? Are you more comfortable writing, more comfortable podcasting, or?
I would say I'm more comfortable writing, in that I can, especially as I said, on those long feature pieces, I can sit down and plan it and change it and amend it and get it until I really am happy with it. I like the idea of having a piece in which every word you think, yeah, I've really nailed that. I think that's exactly what I want to say. And there is a danger. Podcasting, I suppose, is the exact opposite of that, in that you can say something and suddenly be there like, oh, what did I just say? So But at the same time, I think that what's great about podcasting, and we've done it with the daily review shows of England Test cricket, is that we will watch a day's play, and at 7 o'clock when the day's play is over, get online and record a podcast, and at 7:30 it's up, and you get instant reaction. And I think that's the beauty of podcasting, even more so than writing. I mean, we're talking about the internet giving a platform for instant reaction with writing, even more so with podcasting, because literally it takes, you know, 10 minutes to chat and you whack it online.
I guess what's really interesting with your inside-outside cricket point is, you know, if you were able to in the next few years sort of move in as part of a bigger organisation, do you think if you kept podcasting, your tone would have to change? Would you have to be more reverential?
Yeah, I think you would be, and I think that's just a sad fact of the way that cricket and all sport and generally the world works. I think when you're on the inside, you have to be more careful, because, and this is the power that cricket boards, I suppose, if we're talking about cricket, hold, because they're the guys who supply people with accreditation. They're the guy, and you know, you need the accreditation to get jobs that where you can earn significant money. Yeah, yeah. And if you sit there slagging off, you know, the administrators who grant the accreditation, you're not going to get it. So there is certainly an extent to which you've got to rein in. But I think, I mean, Crick Info, I think, again, to bring them up again, Jared Kimber, George DeBell, these guys, I think, are very good at holding the right guys to account, but in the kind of way that they're careful about what they say, because you've got to be. And I hope that that's the way that the rest of the media go in the future.
Now, I think, again, you made a good point about how podcasting is a sort of essential string to a cricket writer's bow. I mean, Twitter, I guess, falls into that same category.
Yeah.
And I've sort of had you as someone I followed on Twitter for a while, and you use it, you know, a lot and seem to use it effectively. I just wondered what advice would you give on that? I mean, is it just a question of using it a lot, or are there kind of tips you would have for people to use it intelligently?
Well, certainly using it a lot helps if you've got the time to use it a lot. I think the main thing in terms of sort of you're talking about gaining traction with followers and getting and more people realizing who you are. I think the biggest thing for me is basically live tweeting of matches. I mean, if you're especially during 2020 matches, because it's only in 3 hours, so you get condensed reaction on Twitter. You get, say, if you've got, you're following 1,000 people on Twitter and most of them are related to cricket, a lot of them are going to be online in a 3 hour period during a 2020 match. And if you're there tweeting out stuff, you're tweeting out stats, little jokes, bits of an analysis, it's a everyone is there kind of thing. And so live tweeting is a massive thing. And then also one thing I do, which I think a lot more people should do, especially journalists, is that I monitor things like Google News and News Now, which basically, as soon as a story can crop up on a really obscure website, it goes straight to that place and then I can tweet it out. And it kind of looks like you're quite on top of the news, which is certainly something which, amongst other writers, I think gains you a lot of respect, in the sense that if you can almost you're not breaking the story because someone else has already written it, but you're drawing attention to the story. So outside live tweeting, that's another thing that I really focus on.
Now, you've been live tweeting on the Champions League 2020, and I mean, I've found it very interesting. I read your preview piece the other day on the Bleacher Report, and I did find it interesting because generally there hasn't been a huge amount of attention or sort of, I think, proper attention given to this by English journalists. I just wondered your thoughts on the tournament, its future, whether you think it's going to turn into the competition that its organisers hope it will.
I'm really, really split on this. I think the Champions League is a very difficult one to analyse. I think that the Champions League is a fantastic concept. It really is. I mean, to bring together the best domestic sides in the world and play a 2020 tournament has massive potential. I think for me, I mean, I'm going to be writing a feature on this in the next few weeks. I think one thing it perhaps is perhaps a little bit ahead of its time. I think obviously in the last 10 years, 2020 has radically changed the landscape of cricket around the world. But it's still a mess. The way that leagues, you know, the Sri Lankan Premier League, for example, has been meant to be staged four times and it's only happened once. Leagues happen and then fail. Teams are created and then go bust. It's not quite, the landscape is not ready for it, I don't think. I think in 15 years, it's something which could work really, really well when leagues are more entrenched, teams are more entrenched, players sort of have more loyalty to their teams.
Well, that final point, I think, is the one I find particularly confusing, and I think I find your preview very useful for, because it is hard when a player, obviously, you know, this concept of the 2020 mercenary, when a player plays for two, in some cases, three teams, it is quite odd to then think, well, who do they then turn up?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea originally with the Champions League was they certainly based it on the football version, and the biggest difference there is that you're going to have Wayne Rooney is only ever going to play for Manchester United. Karen Pollard, for example, is, you know, he could be playing for the Mumbai Indians against the Barbados Tridents, who he captained to the Caribbean Premier League. So that is very confusing. But these things, I think, hopefully over time, as the landscape continues to shift and it continues to move towards 2020 and the calendar opens up for 2020, is something that could certainly work a lot better.
And finally, Freddie, one question that we ask everyone, the sort of kind of chance to go a bit free range. If you were in charge of the ICC, what would be your first move?
Quit, maybe? No, if I was in charge of the ICC, I think one of the things I would do, which would be pretty simple, and they certainly would never do it, but I would revoke the idea of status, the idea of test status, the idea of full member nations. If Papua New Guinea want to play a test match against Nepal, why can't they? The only argument against it is that it's going to ruin statistics, and ultimately, what are statistics in comparison to spreading the game?
To the debate, and this episode we are asking whether the crisis at Leicestershire is a crisis for the entire county game. Now this of course in reference to the events this week at Grace Road, where the player exodus continues. Nathan Buck and Josh Cobb, talented youngsters, have both left the club. The county still haven't won a county championship game for 2 years now. And the financial problems off the pitch continue. And the conversation this week has actually started to turn to Leicestershire's existence, Leicestershire's continuing future as a viable county team.
Now, I do wonder what Charles Darwin would have had to say about this situation, because actually, you know, we've been talking for a long time about the game being too bloated, there being too many teams, there being too many games that happen. And perhaps the fact that a team and a setup and an organisation is clearly not fit for purpose actually is the moment at which we can say maybe we can lose that team from the setup. And particularly the fact that all of the, you know, in essence, all of the decent players have been able to find counties elsewhere, suggests that this isn't going to leave a black hole in the game. Is that just massively unsentimental of me?
I think the problem is it's very easy to talk about reducing the number of counties in the abstract. And I think in the abstract, it makes an awful lot of sense. There is too much cricket in the calendar. And I think within the county game, despite the best efforts to rationalise the schedule, it's still a bit of a mess. I still struggle to keep an eye on what's going on. The problem is when you bring it down to an actual team and you say, okay, we're going to reduce the number of counties and we are going to lose Leicestershire, there is obviously a lot of affection, a lot of fans, a lot of bases to try and keep the county, a lot of support for that. But I mean, it is hard to get away from the point that the county is running into trouble. And the question then becomes, well, is it anyone's job to save it? You know, is it the ECB's job to bail them out? Who, you know, or is it Leicestershire's job, to continue your Darwinian strand of thought, to try to evolve? You know, do they need to find a way of making themselves viable? Is it up to them?
And that point is actually why I think that this is, in a sense, the perfect opportunity to lose a county, because it doesn't require, you know, the powers that be sitting down in the committee room at Lords and deciding which county they're going to, you know, wipe off the map. And actually, it is quite a natural process. It's kind of saying, okay, this county simply isn't able to exist financially or indeed in the standard of cricket that they're playing, and let's just let the process develop inevitably. Having said that, I suppose I'm slightly overstating the case for the sake of the argument. You know, if ever there was a purpose for the ECB, and we pillory the ECB a lot on this podcast, and a lot of people do generally, but if ever there is a purpose for the ECB, presumably it is for them to step in and both to be able to provide immediate support, but also to be able to step in and actually think about restructuring the club in some way. Because what's become very evident is that the club just can't carry on limping on and just hoping that it's somewhere around the corner it's going to suddenly all become good.
I think the one thing that is a bit cruel on Leicestershire here is that you see the players going out this week, and they are young English players who they've invested in, developed. And one question that has been raised, that I think is a very fair one, is are they being properly remunerated for the loss of players who they've invested in, they've developed? I mean, if you think for big counties, it's fantastic if you can almost outsource your player development out to these smaller counties who can do that
James
work.
James Taylor was a name that we didn't mention earlier, but has obviously left the club as well. You know, brilliant batsman, big England prospects. You know, wasn't so long ago that people were saying that he was going to be the next England captain. And it's certainly kind of puts some nails into the coffin, the fact that all of their assets, which absolutely are these players that they've been developing from a very early age, that all of these assets are just sort of disappearing and they are seeing no benefits, and actually it's sort of compounding the problem as well. I mean, in a sense, I think it's possibly quite a good thing that it's come to a head, because actually it means that, as I say, something might get done about it structurally, rather than things just limping on and it's sort of being, you know, talked about, oh, you know, we've got lots of players who have got bad form at the same time. Actually, what needs to happen is something needs to be turned around pretty soon and pretty drastically.
I agree with that, and I think it's going to put both the ECB and Leicestershire's governing body on the spot, basically, and decisions are going to have to be made over the winter, and it'll be extremely interesting to follow that.